Please turn to Matthew chapters 1 and 2. Because in the last few weeks we've been looking together at the first two chapters of Matthew's Gospel, asking what they have to tell us about the Christmas Jesus. Trying to see, if you like, what threads Matthew begins to weave as he starts telling the story of Jesus. So just as a reminder, in our first week together, we said that one of the themes in Matthew chapters 1 and 2 is that Jesus completes God's plan of salvation. Matthew cites passages from the Old Testament 5 times explicitly and says that Jesus came to fulfill those Old Testament scriptures. And in other ways in these chapters, Matthew reminds us that Jesus fulfills God's purposes for the whole of creation, that Jesus fulfills God's promise to Abraham that his descendants would bring blessing to all nations, that Jesus fulfills God's guarantee made to David that a son of David would reign on the throne of David forever, and Jesus fulfills the history of the nation of Israel and brings that history to its culmination. He stands at the head, if you like, of the history of the nation as a whole. So that was the first week. Jesus completes God's plan of salvation. Last week was the theme that Jesus comes for the whole world. And we can see that in the promise that's made to Abraham, we said. We can see that in the foreignness of the women in the genealogy, that they are Gentiles. And we see it especially in the pagan astrologers who seek him and make the long journey in order to worship him and to lay their gifts before him. So Jesus comes for the whole world. And what we can begin to see with these themes, I hope, is that Matthew has not just thrown these stories together any old how. No, he's carefully arranged these stories in his gospel to bring out these unifying threads. And if we had the time to follow them, we would see that these threads that Matthew begins in chapters 1 and 2, actually he takes them into his gospel right the way through to the very last page. So all the way through Matthew's gospel, we learn that Jesus completes God's plan of salvation. We learn that Jesus comes for the whole world. And that, of course, comes to its great climax right at the very end of the gospel, where the disciples are sent out to make disciples of all nations. And so we come to our third and final week in Matthew chapters 1 and 2. And we come to our third theme, which also stretches in these chapters and then reaches into the rest of the gospel as well. And the theme is this: Jesus challenges ideas of social status and power. Jesus challenges ideas of social status and power. Now that too is significant for Matthew. At the time of Jesus and at the time of Matthew, people had all sorts of ideas about what the Messiah, the promised king, the promised son of David should be like. All sorts of ideas. And what Matthew does is he tells us what the true king, the true son of David, is really like. What he does, if you like, is he rewrites the script. He recasts the identity and the character of the Messiah, what the king should really be like. And in doing so, he challenges our ideas of social status and power, and what social status and power really mean. So that's what we're going to look at today in this last of our times in Matthew chapters 1 and 2. And there are at least 4 ways that Matthew does this in these opening chapters. And the first way is through Mary. There's the heading on the overhead. Mary and Jesus' irregular ancestry. Now look again at chapter 1. We have Jesus' ancestry laid out for us in the genealogy that you can see there, the list of names in chapter 1, verses 1 to 17, a record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. It goes all the way through to verse 17, thus there were 14 generations in all from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the exile to Babylon, and 14 from the exile to the Christ. Now we said last week, if you were here, you might recall, that we do not anticipate the mention of women in the genealogy. Do you remember? There are some women in Jesus' family tree. Now not only are they women, which is significant in a genealogy, and not only are they Gentile women, which, as we said last week, is also significant, but each woman, including Mary, has the whiff of scandal hanging over her. The women in Jesus' genealogy are united, including Mary, because remember, Mary is not a Gentile. But Mary is united to the other women in Jesus' family tree by having suspicions of illegitimacy surrounding their marriage unions and their childbearing. Now let's remind ourselves about Tamar, for example. She's mentioned in verse 3. Take a look at verse 3. Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. So Matthew reminds us about Tamar. Now her story is told in Genesis chapter 38. We haven't got time to look at it in detail, but let me remind us of the story there. Tamar is actually Judah's daughter-in-law, not his wife at all. She's his daughter-in-law. Tamar has two husbands who both die. And Judah won't give his sons to her so that she can have any descendants. So Tamar disguises herself as a prostitute and ends up getting pregnant by Judah, her father-in-law. Pretty sordid. It's there. Some of you are looking at me like I'm making this stuff up. I'm not. It's there in Genesis chapter 38. You read it when you get home. But it's precisely through this somewhat sordid incident that Perez is born, there in Jesus' genealogy, and from Perez eventually comes David, and from David eventually comes Jesus. So God works through this soap opera incident in the history of his people, and Tamar and her son Perez become part of Christ's family tree. It's there in verse 3, the third verse of the New Testament. And then later, although she is a prostitute, Rahab, do you remember Rahab in Joshua? She too is brought into the messianic line. Ruth, well, Ruth, of course, is a Moabite outsider. The Moabites had their origins in incest, Lot and his daughters. Ruth has no right, really, to marry an Israelite. And yet Ruth becomes the grandmother of King David. And then comes David himself and his illicit relationship with the wife of Uriah. That's what she's called there, isn't it, in verse 6. The wife of Uriah, Bathsheba. With that incident, but God chooses to work through one of David's lowest points. And from their union comes Solomon, and eventually, down the line, comes Christ. And so it is, we read that Mary, who's pledged to be married to Joseph, verse 18, but before they came together, she was found to be with child. So here she is, an engaged young woman, pregnant with a child, not fathered by Joseph. So here is a potential sexual scandal right at the beginning of the gospel. But do you see what Matthew has done in his genealogy? He's included these key women from Israel's history in his genealogy to show that similar suspicions surrounded them too. But God worked through them. What a family tree. Jesus is the Messiah. Not through respectable channels, necessarily. Not through expected channels. But under a cloud of sexual scandal. Why would God choose to make Mary pregnant so long before her marriage that she would become subject to gossip and humiliation and possible divorce? Why would God not want the birth of Jesus to fall in the boundaries, inside the boundaries of what was morally and socially acceptable? Why would God allow Jesus' origins to be subject to the whispers of sexual scandal and accusations of illegitimacy? We have to say we don't really know when push comes to shove. It's the way God chooses to work. But as Matthew reminds us, God doesn't always work out his purpose within the boundaries of public respectability. Public moral expectations. God's work can sometimes take the form of scandal and risk. So God, in his grace and his wisdom, will work through Tamar's deception of Judah. God, through his grace and wisdom, will work through David's adultery with Bathsheba. Not to say that those things are all right, but to show that nothing will stop his plan of salvation from coming to fruition. Irregularity, you see. So we've got this suggestion, this slight suggestion of illegitimacy surrounding these women a number of occasions. And that fits very well with the inclusion of Mary in the genealogy. And that also fits very well with the very next incident, which is about Joseph. There's the second heading, Joseph as Jesus' adoptive father. Because in chapter 1, verses 18 to 25, this theme of illegitimacy continues. As we go through the genealogy, you see, we have the pattern of so-and-so was the father of so-and-so, and so-and-so was the father of so-and-so. And when we come to verse 16, we might expect to read, and Joseph was the father of Jesus. But we don't. Have a look at verse 16. Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who is called Christ. So Matthew deliberately breaks the pattern that he set up there in the genealogy. Joseph is not the father of Jesus. Matthew makes that clear. He seems to go out of his way to say that Joseph wasn't the father of Jesus. Joseph was the husband of Mary, and it was from Mary that Jesus was born. But what becomes clear in the next incident, verse 18 onwards, is that Joseph adopts Jesus. And that's important for Matthew. The Messiah, of course, the king, comes from the line of David, as the genealogy makes clear. Jesus is the son of David. And it's important, therefore, that it's mentioned that Joseph is also a son of David. Take a look at verse 20. After he had considered this, that is, divorcing Mary, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said, Joseph, son of David. That's important. Having considered whether to divorce Mary quietly, an angel persuades Joseph in a dream to take Mary as his wife and to give her son the name Jesus. All of which we are told Joseph does. Verse 24, when Joseph woke up, he did what the angel of the Lord had commanded him and took Mary home as his wife. But he had no union with her until she gave birth to a son, and he gave him the name Jesus. So what Matthew does in this incident, he tells us how Jesus came to be formally adopted and named by Joseph, who was himself a son of David, so that Jesus himself becomes officially a son of David. Joseph as Jesus' adoptive father. But this theme of legitimacy and illegitimacy continues into chapter 2 as well, with the third heading there, Herod and Jesus' true kingship. So we've got suspicions of illegitimacy here as well, where we have a deliberate contrast in chapter 2 between two kings. A contrast between Jesus and Herod. Who is the legitimate king of the Jews? Herod may well be the king legally, but he is not the legitimate king. So we read, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, chapter 2, verse 1, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews?" Now that has the sense of, where is the one who has been born rightly as the king of the Jews and is not the king of the Jews by some other spurious means? So they're actually saying to the king of the Jews, Herod, who is nominally the king of the Jews, where is the one who's been born king of the Jews? You see? See how it's set up? The contrast between Herod, who is the king, but Jesus, who is the true king of the Jews. And following on from last week, we need to note that the different responses to Jesus' birth here are not just a contrast between unbelieving Jews on the one hand and believing Gentiles on the other hand. No, the contrast is more a social one. It's more a political one. It's more a status division between those who have power, like Herod, and the religious elites, the chief priests and the scribes and the teachers of the law, those who have power, and those who are apparently powerless and insignificant and on the margins, like pagan astrologers, and Joseph, and Mary. So you see, here we have what we referred to earlier as the rewriting of the messianic script, the kingly script. What kind of king will Jesus be? Well, this passage tells us, it gives us a clue. Most of the references are to Jesus as the child. And he's entirely passive. He is born of Mary. He's announced by a star. He's worshipped. He's presented with gifts by the Magi. He's sought by Herod. He's taken to Egypt. He's taken back to Israel. He's a powerless refugee child whose life is in danger and who has to flee the country. Herod, by contrast, shows all the characteristics of what we tend to think of as power. He orders people around. He questions them. He makes them do his bidding. He brings fear and death. And it will take the rest of the story of the gospel to tell us that Jesus' life and ministry will be shaped by a different kind of power than the power of Herod's in the world. Jesus will teach his disciples to love their enemies and not to return violence with violence. Jesus' power will be exercised in healing, in liberating those who are gripped by demonic forces. Jesus' power will be exercised not by killing or by ordering the killing of others, like Herod does, but Jesus' power will be exercised in dying for others, so that others may have life. Because that's the kind of king Jesus is. That's what true kingship means, so far as the gospel story is concerned. Jesus' power shone not in violence, but in vulnerability. Not with a sword in his hand, but with a cross on his back. And it's there, brothers and sisters, in Matthew chapter 2. What kind of king will Jesus be? Now that is scandalous. So far as the world is concerned, that is scandalous. But as Paul says to the Corinthians, the message of the cross is scandalous to the world. It is foolish to those who are perishing. And here it is in Matthew chapter 2. Fourthly and finally, we've had Mary and Jesus' irregular ancestry, Joseph as Jesus' adoptive father, Herod and Jesus' true kingship, and finally, Nazareth as Jesus' despised home. Now, you may recall, if you were here our first week together, in chapter 2, each of the quotations from the Old Testament mentions the name of a place. Let's remind ourselves of that. So in 2 verse 6, we have an Old Testament passage from Micah 5 verse 2. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler. So it's Bethlehem, the birthplace of David. Go down to chapter 2 and verse 15, and we have here the quotation from Hosea 11 verse 1, which reads, out of Egypt I called my son. There's a second place. Now, Egypt, of course, we associate in the Old Testament with the Exodus. And Matthew seems to be making the point here that in Jesus, another Exodus is happening again, that just as God brought his son Israel out of Egypt, so now God is bringing Jesus, his son, out of Egypt. And then we have verse 18, where we have the quotation from Jeremiah chapter 31, a voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children. So there's a third place mentioned in an Old Testament quotation. And Ramah was associated with the exile. And then at the end of Matthew chapter 2, Matthew ends this chapter by showing how Jesus ends up in Nazareth and is called a Nazarene. So, verse 23, he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, he will be called a Nazarene. And there's the fourth geographical reference, Nazarene, Nazareth. So you see, we've got this movement, Bethlehem, Egypt, Ramah, Nazareth. And the Old Testament quotations pick every movement of Jesus out. He will be called a Nazarene. Now, we said in our first week, actually, there is no such reference in the Old Testament. He will be called a Nazarene. You will not find that anywhere in the Old Testament. What are we to make of this? Is this a problem? Well, the answer is probably that Matthew is not referring to a specific text, but to a theme that is found in the prophets. Now, in fact, Matthew himself gives us a clue, because look very carefully. Did you notice what he said? He tells us that this is what the Lord spoke through the prophets, plural, not the prophet, singular, through the prophets in the plural. So Matthew himself admits that he's not actually drawing on a specific quotation here. But actually, he's suggesting that what we should look for is a theme in the prophets as a whole. And that theme, I'd like to suggest to you, is the theme that the Messiah would be despised, rejected, a man of sorrows, familiar with suffering, like one from whom people would hide their face, so that we don't esteem him, we despise him. And that's a theme that's found not just in Isaiah 53, where I've lifted some of those quotations from, but elsewhere in the Old Testament too. And that fits with Jesus being brought up in Nazareth. Part of the point of what Matthew is doing here in chapter 2 is showing how Jesus, who was born in Bethlehem, eventually ended up in Nazareth, and that each move was a fulfillment of Scripture. Nazareth. Now, it's worth reminding ourselves that Nazareth and Galilee had an unsavory reputation. Nazareth was 70 miles north of Jerusalem. So in first century Palestine, there was a real north-south divide, in the same way that some people think there is in England today. You know, you've got the rich capital city down there in the south, Jerusalem, and 70 miles north in the hill country, you've got Galilee. And in Galilee is Nazareth. And Galilee was associated with political revolution, and it was associated with incorrect Jewish observance. It was as good as foreign territory. In fact, sometimes Galilee was referred to as Galilee of the Gentiles, because it was surrounded on all sides by Gentile territory. And the Galileans had a reputation for being uncultured, and a reputation for, you know, for talking funny up there, because they drop all their H's and stuff like that. And I've said on previous occasions, I know maybe some of you have not heard, I've said on previous occasions that Galilee was like the Liverpool of the first century. Now, I don't speak with a Scouse accent very much now, although people who are from Liverpool, I was born and brought up in Liverpool, but people who are from Liverpool can still hear a faint Scouse twang in my voice. And we're immediately after this service today, we're going back up to see relatives, and I can pretty much guarantee you that within 2 hours, I'll be talking like a thick Scouser again, like, all right. And of course, the Galileans had a funny accent in the first century, and we know that because when Peter's warming his fire down in Jerusalem, they recognize where he's from, because the servant girl says, I know you, I'm pretty sure you must belong to them, because you talk like they do, you've got a funny accent. When people find out I was born in Liverpool, they immediately assume I'm a car-thieving football hooligan. You know, they're checking their pockets for their car keys, because there are certain assumptions that go with the territory, aren't there? You know, it's like the old observation that you can tell who the Scousers are at a wedding because they're the ones with the carnations in their shell suits. Now, here, you've got to put yourself in. That's the mindset, okay, in the first century. Because I wonder, can we really cope with the thought of Jesus speaking with a rough, uncultured, northern, possibly Liverpudlian accent? So when Jesus of Nazareth and his band of Galilean disciples present himself to Israel, the people of Israel, as the fulfillment of their hopes, the reaction is completely predictable. How can the Messiah come from Nazareth? From Galilee? Are you kidding me? And yet, God chooses despised Nazareth in Galilee of the Gentiles to be the hometown of his son. Would you do that? Would I do that? No way. But then God's ways aren't our ways, are they? So you see, this then is the third theme that I think we see woven through these opening chapters of Matthew's Gospel. And a theme as well that if we had time, we could see how it spins out in the rest of the Gospel as a whole. Jesus challenges our ideas of social status and power. Jesus, born under a cloud of sexual impropriety, of illegitimacy, suspected illegitimacy, taken as a refugee to Egypt, living life as a ridiculed Nazarene, dying as a criminal on a Roman cross, a God-forsaken king of the Jews. How's that for the mysterious providence of God? Scandalous. Are we embarrassed by scandal? Are we hurt by scandal? Whether it's our own scandal or someone else's scandal, sexual scandal or some other kind of scandal. Do we feel we have to be embarrassed for God's sake by scandal? Do we think he's not quite big enough to cope with it? Or do we think he can work through it? Even use it in his wisdom? Well, he can. The story of Jesus tells us that he can. What about power? What do we think about power? Do we still think that power is about being in charge? About dishing out orders? About expecting people to take us seriously? Is that what power is really about? The answer is no, isn't it? Because we learn again from the one who came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. As 2008 starts and as 2008 unfolds, let's worship this Jesus, this Christmas Jesus, the Jesus who completes God's plan of salvation, the Jesus who comes for the whole world, and the Jesus who challenges our ideas of social status and power. Let's worship this Jesus to his own glory. Amen.